Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Federalism and Separation of Powers Practice Group, was recorded on Thursday, February 11th, 2016, during a live teleforum conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members.
Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group teleforum conference call on United States versus Texas, the upcoming Supreme Court case on President Obama's executive actions on immigration. My name is Katie McClendon. I'm the Director of Publications at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Also note that this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. Today we welcome our experts, Professor John C. Eastman, Henry Salvatore Professor of Law and Community Service at Chapman University School of Law, and Professor Kevin R. Johnson, Dean and Mabee Apollos, Professor of Public Interest Law and Chicana and Chicano Studies at the University of California, Davis School of Law. Professor Eastman will give some opening remarks, followed by Professor Johnson, and then we will open the floor for your questions. Thank you for speaking with us, Professor Eastman. The floor is yours.
Thank you very much, and thanks to the Federal Society for hosting this teleforum and to Dean Johnson for joining me in what I expect will be a lively discussion. The issue, of course, is the legality of the president's executive actions, and I use that phrase very carefully because they're not executive orders. They are guidance memos issued by the Department of Homeland Security, both Secretary Napolitano and then Secretary Jay Johnson. Effectively suspending the deportation requirements for upwards of 5 million immigrants who are in this country unlawfully. Texas and a number of other states brought suit challenging the legality of the president's orders. They raised a multiple number of claims, including that this was a dramatic change in interpretation of the law that needed to be implemented, if at all, by the Administrative Procedure Act's notice and comment rulemaking rather than by a memo. But the state of Texas and its sister states bringing the suit also challenged the legality of the president's orders under the Take Care Clause of the Constitution. That's provision in Article 2 that says that the president is obligated to take care that the laws be faithfully executed. The lower courts, although weighing in heavily in their opinions about their views on that substantive merits question, the district court preliminary enjoined the president's actions as for violating the Administrative Procedure Act and its notice and comment rulemaking procedures. And the United States asked for a quick response and cert petition to the Supreme Court, which was granted on January 19th. However, the Supreme Court added the Take Care Clause into the questions presented at Texas's urging in their opposition to the cert petition, that if you're going to take this case, you ought to address the substantive merits. And I'm going to focus mostly on the substantive merits question here. And it seems to me there are two rather dramatic questions that are presented. First of all, how far does the president's use of prosecutorial discretion? And everybody recognizes that every executive has prosecutorial discretion. We don't have to bring an indictment in the criminal context for every single violation of the law. It would be impossible to do so. For example, if you're driving on a highway and you're a few miles over the speed limit, you're breaking the law. But if you pass a highway patrol officer, if you're only going a few miles over the speed limit, they're typically not going to pull you over. That's an exercise of prosecutorial discretion. But the Supreme Court has, for a very long time, been pretty clear that there's a limit on prosecutorial discretion, that when you instead categorically change the substance of the law rather than applying that discretion on a case-by-case basis, you have suspended the law instead of exercising prosecutorial discretion. And so the first part of that question presented is going to address where that line is, and if it's too difficult to draw that line, does this aspect of the case end up being a non-justiciable political question? The Supreme Court has never resolved that issue. They've recognized the issue is there, going all the way back to an 1838 case where the court held in Kendall versus Stokes to contend that the obligation imposed on the president to see the laws faithfully executed implies a power to forbid their execution is a novel construction of the Constitution and entirely inadmissible. And then only and much more recently in 1985 in a case called Heckler versus Cheney, Supreme Court recognized that there would be times when judicial review of the exercises of enforcement discretion would be available, such as when an agency adopts a general policy that is an abdication of its statutory responsibilities to enforce the law. And so teasing out that line suggested in Heckler versus Cheney is what the first part of this is going to be. And by the way, this is something that the executive itself has recognized. In the memos by the Office of Legal Counsel purporting to rationalize or validate the president's executive actions here, the Office of Legal Counsel says that the executive branch ordinarily cannot consciously and expressly adopt a general policy that is so extreme as to amount to an abdication of its statutory responsibilities. A general policy of non-enforcement that forecloses the exercise of case-by-case discretion poses special risks, the memo notes, that the agency has exceeded the bounds of its enforcement discretion. And I think that's absolutely right. Now, even before you get that, there's a preliminary question on whether the normal prosecutorial discretion that we all recognize exists even applies in this context. Because remember, deportation proceedings are not criminal matters, they are civil matters. And there is some question whether prosecutorial discretion even applies there, particularly because the statute itself says anybody who is not eligible shall, uses the word shall, be processed for deportation. On that ground, the Northern District of Texas, the only court to have considered that precise issue, says whatever prosecutorial discretion might have existed in this context is taken away by that statutory language. Now, that decision is not a binding authority. The court subsequently ruled that it didn't have jurisdiction in the case because it was a case brought by Border Patrol agents, and the exclusive jurisdiction for the case, therefore, was vested in the Merit Systems Protection Board. Nevertheless, I think the court's initial ruling on that question has much merit. But even if we accept that the president has enough prosecutorial discretion to determine effectively to rewrite the law, and we've got to be honest here, that's what's gone on. For decades, people have tried to get these provisions through Congress. They have not succeeded, and the president effectively adopted the DREAM Act in sum and substance after stating for years that he had no constitutional authority to do so. I think he most famously said at one point back in 2011, "I'm the president, I'm not a king." Later, he says, "I'm the president of the United States, not the emperor of the United States. I can't do this on my own. It has to be done by act of Congress." And yet, he has effectively done that on his own. But even if you accept that he has the broad discretion he claims, and even if you that he doesn't have that broad discretion, but the courts can't figure out how to draw the line, and so we'll treat it as a non-justiciable controversy. There's another aspect of this that I don't think there's any question does not fall within the exercise of prosecutorial discretion, and that's the aspect of which involves not just not initiating deportation proceedings or canceling deportation proceedings or deportation orders that were already underway or in effect, but then conferring a lawful presence designation on those who are here unlawfully and making them eligible for work authorization, for Social Security benefits, for retroactive payment of earned income tax credits off of their tax returns and what have you. Something I think that goes beyond any notion of prosecutorial discretion. As the general counsel for the Immigration and Naturalization Service noted during the Clinton administration back in July of 2000, quote, "The doctrine of prosecutorial discretion applies to enforcement decisions, not benefit decisions. For example, a decision to charge or not to charge an alien with a ground of deportability is clearly a prosecutorial enforcement decision. By contrast, the grant of an immigration benefit, such as naturalization or adjustment of status, is a benefit decision that is not a subject for prosecutorial discretion, close quote. And I think that's absolutely right. And yet, nevertheless, despite very carefully wrought and somewhat Byzantine immigration statutes on the books that do not allow for work authorization for illegal immigrants, except in very carefully circumscribed and well-defined exceptions, the president has basically directed, or rather his secretaries of Homeland Security basically directed, the issuance on a whole wide scale of work authorizations that are contrary to the statute. When Secretary Janet Napolitano first did this, they didn't even cite any legal authority for that. 2 years later, when Jay Johnson added the DAPA program in November of 2014, they honed in on five words in a definitional section of this, one of the immigration statutes, section H3, which defines unauthorized alien as any alien who is not lawfully admitted for permanent residence. And there are several provisions in the statutes that allow aliens to be designated as admitted for permanent residence, or an alien authorized to be employed by the work authorization chapter. And then it says, or by the Attorney General. And it's that, those last five words that the administration now claims gives the executive branch unfettered discretion to decide to issue work authorizations to anybody here unlawfully in the United States that it chooses. And much more likely that those five words just simply refer to a lot of other provisions in the immigration laws that give specific authority to the Attorney General, for example, for somebody assisting in an ongoing criminal investigation for human trafficking. The Attorney General has the authority to give that person a lawful status in the United States and a work authorization. There are a number of other provisions like that, and much more likely that phrase just refers to those provisions. If it doesn't, if it really means what the president has claimed it means, or the president's lawyers have claimed it means, then there is absolutely no discretion whatsoever, and we run into a major constitutional problem. It's called the non-delegation doctrine, and that is derived from Article 1, Section 1, the very first substantive provision of the Constitution. It says all the legislative powers herein granted are vested in a Congress of the United States. And the court has long recognized that Congress doesn't get to pass that lawmaking authority to anybody else. It can pass fill-in-the-blank authority, but it can only do so if it gives an intelligible principle. And the president's claim here, with these words, there is no intelligible principle whatsoever that would violate the non-delegation doctrine, even if it's rather moribund state that we have right now. So with that, I will pass it off to Dean Johnson.
Okay. I also want to thank the Federalist Society for sponsoring this call and inviting me to participate. And I want to thank John Eastman for his thoughtful comments. I look at the issues slightly differently, and I think to me they're a little more complicated about what they are and how the court will resolve them. And I want to give a little bit of background, because I think it's important to understand what we're addressing in this particular case. Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program was promulgated in 2012. It provides temporary, not permanent, relief from deportation to certain eligible undocumented immigrants who came here when they were children. It's not the subject of the case in the Supreme Court. Its legal underpinnings may be implicated by the court's reasoning, but it's not the program that's before the Supreme Court. The program that is before the Supreme Court is the Deferred Action for Parental Arrivals of U.S. citizens, Americans, and lawful permanent residents, and that was put together and announced in November 2014. And that allows parents of U.S. citizens, undocumented parents of U.S. citizens and lawful permanent residents, to obtain temporary relief from removal. And the president articulated these programs based on the idea of prosecutorial discretion, that there is discretion in the executive to decide who to seek removal of. And there's a long history of prosecutorial discretion in terms of immigration. And actually, there's a recent book on it by Shoba Wadia, about its historical roots in immigration in particular. And Justice Scalia, in the Arab American Anti-Discrimination Committee decision 1999, discusses in some detail prosecutorial discretion in immigration decisions. So it's not something that was articulated first by the Obama administration, but something that's been in place for a long, long period of time. Now, DACA, as it's known, and DAPA are programs that came about after a number of years, a long political debate about what some people term comprehensive immigration reform. There's been discussions in Congress for many years about immigration reform, and to this point, no immigration reform has really been passed. There's still discussion, there's still debate. In fact, we hear the presidential candidates debating it on a pretty regular basis. With the failure of comprehensive immigration reform, what happened was a number of states and local governments began passing their own immigration enforcement laws. And the Supreme Court addressed one of those laws in a case, Arizona versus United States, decided in 2012, and struck down core provisions of Arizona's SB 1070, finding that they were preempted by federal immigration law. And in reaching that decision, the majority emphasized the discretion in the U.S. government in how to and when to enforce the immigration laws, and how that power, removal and enforcement, was best placed in the federal government, and that Congress intended it to be placed in the federal government. So that was sort of the next step in the political debate over immigration reform. After that, that's when we see DACA and DAPA being announced and becoming actually DACA was implemented, DAPA wasn't. What happened in DAPA was a district court entered a preliminary injunction on a number of grounds that they'll get to in a minute. The Fifth Circuit, in a 2-1 decision, upheld the preliminary injunction. And so to this point, DAPA has not been implemented, and it's been on hold for over a year at this point. DACA has been implemented and has been in effect for several years, and actually DACA reapplications have already been submitted and accepted and granted in some circumstances. But the relief under the Deferred Action Program, both under DACA and DAPA, is temporary. It's not permanent. People can be removed if they commit a crime, and they have been denied relief at various points in time too for under DACA. So it's not an automatic grant of any kind of relief. So against this sort of backdrop of political debate about immigration at the state, local, and federal level, you have the president announce DAPA. It's immediately attacked in the courts by 26 states, led by Texas, and three issues are currently before the Supreme Court, and they're distinct issues, and they're important to think about them separately. One is, and I'll go into some detail about each of them in a second. One of them is standing, whether the states have standing to challenge DAPA. The second is whether, actually, and the Fifth Circuit found that there was standing. The second question is whether the DAPA program was announced in violation of the Administrative Procedure Act. It wasn't subject to notice and comment as the Act requires. And the question is, should it have been? And that's where the Fifth Circuit found, a majority of the Fifth Circuit found that it wasn't promulgated in accordance with the Administrative Procedure Act. The last issue, and this is an issue that's a challenging one to analyze for me anyway, is the one under Article 2, that is that the president has to take care to faithfully execute the laws. And I'll tell you in a second why I find that issue be particularly hard to get a feel for. Now, the standing issue, I don't want to go into too much detail. I did post something on the SCOTUS blog this morning offering my analysis of the standing question. And the critical issue there is whether under Article 3 the states have standing to challenge DAPA. And the specific issue is whether Texas has suffered an injury in fact resulting from the DAPA program. And I find the cases to be not the easiest to apply to this particular set of facts. There are two cases that I guess I would point to as being particularly relevant here. Massachusetts versus the Environmental Protection Agency, where the Supreme Court found that the state of Massachusetts had standing to challenge a Bush administration decision not to regulate greenhouse gases. The state of Massachusetts in that case claimed that the failure to regulate would allow for the deterioration and elimination of some coastal shorelines, and that was the concrete injury the court found was sufficient to confer standing on the state. The other case, and that's actually very relevant here, and I'll talk about why that case arguably is distinguishable in a second. The second case that's relevant is Lujan versus Defenders of Wildlife, a 1992 decision that found that environmental organizations lacked standing to challenge some regulations under the Endangered Species Act. And I think that that's a case that John Roberts later wrote a law review article about, talking about how Lujan was a sensible decision because it kept litigants out of the political process, out of the political fray, and left to Congress and the executive branch the power to work that out themselves, the political branches of the federal government. But the standing question here is an interesting one. The state of Texas is the one that convinced the Fifth Circuit that it had suffered a concrete injury in fact. And it's only the state of Texas that met that threshold. The other states didn't provide the necessary information to the courts to have a ruling on their alleged injury. It was only the state of Texas. Now, there's a whole set of questions that civil procedure experts would focus on here, and that is, how can a nationwide injunction be issued based on the injury of one state? And the state of Texas' injury was this. They claimed that they would have to issue driver's license to the recipients of the deferred action, and that the cost of issuing driver's licenses was sufficient to confer standing on them. Now, some would say that this is a self-imposed cost. It's the state of Texas, not DAPA, that says you have to give driver's licenses to DAPA recipients. And it's the state of Texas that says that it wants to subsidize the driver's licenses to all people get them, meaning that the cost of their issuance isn't charged to the licensee. So some would say that injury is very different than the injury in Massachusetts versus the Environmental Protection Agency. It's a self-imposed injury. It's about cost of driver's licenses. It's not the same as losing coastline if you're a state. And some would also say that this kind of case, clearly a political piece of litigation, really is the kind of case that Lujan versus Defenders of Wildlife and John Roberts, in his law review article, thought didn't belong in the federal courts, and thought that the framers actually, in crafting Article III, created this standing doctrine to limit these kinds of political lawsuits. And in many ways, this does have many of the appearances of a political lawsuit. Another factor some would point to is, well, not even all the states are in agreement on this. Some states, like Texas, think that DAPA is unlawful. Other states, like Washington, New York, and California, don't even think this case belongs in federal court. In fact, they filed an amicus brief in favor of the cert petition, arguing that there was no standing. So that's the standing question. And if the court dismisses the case on standing grounds, then it won't get to the next two questions. It could, but it probably wouldn't. Now, the next question is, well, does DAPA have to satisfy the notice and comment requirements of the Administrative Procedure Act? In this instance, the program was announced. It wasn't subject to notice and comment. So if the court were to find that the APA subjects DAPA to notice and comment requirements, then it's clear that in the end, this program couldn't go into effect, and it would have to be sent back down for the appropriate procedure to be followed. Now, the Obama administration says this isn't subject to notice and comment requirements of the APA. The DAPA program is a general statement of policy and guidance, and it's termed a guidance in the issuing documents, the various memorandums that announce it. But the state of Texas says this is something very different. It's not a statement of general policy. This is a substantive rule that, in fact, is subject to notice and comment and the requirements of the Administrative Procedure Act. I do think that there are colorable arguments to be made on both sides of this. I do think that there is an argument that this is a general statement of policy about the exercise of prosecutorial discretion in an effort to make sure that the various trial attorneys in the agency comply with a general set of guidelines. And there are other guidances in for example, U.S. attorney manuals that are somewhat similar to this. So it's not that extraordinary. At the same time, I do understand that, the claim that this is something more than just guidance and guidelines. In fact, there are impacts, and it's a broad policy that does provide some relief. So I think that's a harder question if we get to the APA. The last question, the one that I've said it's hard for me to get a full feel for, is the Take Care Clause argument under Article 3. And this is an interesting one because the petition for certiorari by the U.S. government didn't ask for this question to be taken up by the court. The court on its own motion really decided that it was going to take it up. I personally am not exactly sure what that means, why they decided to take that up. And the issue that comes to my mind is we don't have a lot of case law about what the Take Care Clause is all about, and we don't have a Supreme Court decision talking how it would be implemented in force, and so we're in somewhat of an unknown place about how the court might well address this. The court does certainly want this to be part of the bigger issue in the case or one of the set of issues in the case, but I'm not precisely sure where it's going to go with it. It is important to know that if a very strict interpretation of the Take Care Clause were to be adopted by the court, it could have impacts on the exercises of all kinds of prosecutorial discretion decisions, from IRS decisions to criminal decisions to decisions to enforce the provisions of the Environmental Protection Act. I'm sure that people will be carefully watching just where the court goes with this if it takes it up. I tend to think that the case in the end will probably be decided on standing or Administrative Procedure Act grounds, but it's unclear to me if the court does address the Take Care part, how it so addresses it. Let me end there because I'm sure there'll be plenty of questions.
Thank you both for your comments. I'll now open the floor to your questions. In a moment, you'll hear a prompt indicating that the floor mode has been turned on. After that, to request the floor, enter star and then pound. When we get to your request, you will hear a prompt and then you may ask your question. We will answer questions in the order in which they are received. Again, to ask a question, please enter star and then pound on your telephone keypad.
And while we're waiting for the first questions to come in, this is John Eastman. Maybe I can have a brief response. The court's standing cases that Dean Johnson relies on, I think, deal more with private actors. The significance of the Massachusetts versus EPA case is really one that is going to apply the traditional standing rules or barriers to standing in a much less vigorous way when the state is acting in its capacity as a sovereign. And remember, the claimed injury in the Massachusetts versus EPA case was that if the Environmental Protection Agency in Washington, D.C. did not regulate global warming, carbon dioxide emissions that in the claims view, contribute to global warming. That the seas would rise and that would cause harm to the residents of Massachusetts sometime over the next century. And normally that would be much too speculative to qualify for standing in the normal rules. And Dean Johnson rightly points to the Lujan case as kind of setting those rules. And they did so because it treated the state as a sovereign differently. Texas's claim of standing here is, in my view, much more immediate and direct than Massachusetts was. And there are two claims. One is that because existing state law requires the issuance of driver's licenses to anybody who is in deferred action status at the federal level, that this overwhelming number of new illegal immigrants who are put in that status by virtue of the president's orders gives them standing to challenge the constitutionality of those orders. They don't have to change their state law to avoid the harm, and the court's been pretty clear about that in the past. They have a state policy that they want to keep. It's now been dramatically altered as a result of federal action. If those federal actions are unconstitutional, the states don't have a problem and don't need to consider changing their state policy. If those actions are constitutional, the states can only avoid the increased cost by changing their own state policy, which is enough to establish standing. And that's just the kind of direct and immediate cost standing. It could also, in my view, have raised a Massachusetts versus EPA claim that the overwhelming number of illegal immigrants that are now enticed to stay in the country as a result of these programs and the added incentives puts an added illegal immigration burden on Texas in a much more direct and immediate way than the global warming burden that was at issue in Massachusetts versus EPA. So I think on either of those fronts, I think Texas has a very strong argument on standing. I think that's why the district court found that they had standing in a very thorough, lengthy opinion, and why the Fifth Circuit affirmed that. I will say this, though, if the Supreme Court decides that they don't have standing, that would not leave us with any Supreme Court decision on whether what the president is doing here is constitutional or not. So, too, with the Administrative Procedures Act piece. If the court decides to punt on the substantive merits by saying, well, they should have gone through notice and comment rulemaking, we could end up going through that notice and comment rulemaking, although I suspect a new administration may have a different view about these things than the current one does, which could well moot the whole case. But after going through that notice and comment rulemaking, we could end up back before the Supreme Court saying, well, now that you've gone through the right process, is what you did constitutional at all? And that makes the Administrative Procedure Act exercise potentially a futile exercise, and that may be why the court added the take care clause, the substantive merits question, here to the questions presented right now. So why go through that drill if at the end of the day what they're doing is unconstitutional anyway?
Could I add a word?
I was going to say, please respond while we wait for our next question. And I'll remind our listeners that you press star and then pound to ask a question. Go ahead.
I wasn't aware that there was really any special rule in Article 3 conferring standing on the states. There is this statement in Massachusetts versus EPA suggesting that. I would have thought, John, that you weren't a big supporter of Massachusetts versus EPA when it was decided. And that you would have thought that it shouldn't be in court. It is the law, and it can be used for arguments. But I'm not so sure that in this circumstance the court would even reaffirm that decision. And in fact, I think that it might deviate from it, in especially some of the language in it that talks about special solicitude for the states in terms of standing. It does seem to me that case, like this case, raises very, very political issues that really are best resolved in the political branches as opposed to the courts. But if the court decides to reaffirm sort of special standing for the states, then you know then this case might proceed. Now, in terms of the injury, and that's actually a good point that you raised, both points. I do think there arguably are some costs to the state from the driver's licenses, although that's not in DAPA, that's in the state law, and to the extent that the state doesn't change it, that does make it somewhat self-imposed. Now, if one were to make the argument, and I don't think it was adopted by the Fifth Circuit, that DAPA would increase the cost to the states because of undocumented immigration, that would mean that a state could challenge any decision or would have standing to challenge any decision of the federal government on immigration. It seems to me an individual removal decision, any kind of program. And I'll give you an example of a program that comes to my mind. In the November 2014 set of orders and memorandums that were issued, not orders but actions, memorandums that were issued, there's a new program created. One program was abolished, the Secure Communities Program, that focused on criminal non-citizens subject to removal. It's very broad in scope. And the administration announced a new priority enforcement program that was narrower in scope and focused removal efforts on immigrants who had been convicted of, not merely arrested for, but convicted of serious crimes. And it is a new program. It's a change from the old program. If standing could be conferred based on the costs of immigration or the alleged costs of immigration, which are always very difficult to prove depending on which economist you talk to, I could imagine the state of Texas and other states, they wanted to be able to challenge the priority enforcement program and basically challenge almost any immigration decision at all made by the executive branch, which would really open the doors to the federal courts to do exactly what the Supreme Court was trying to avoid in Arizona versus the United States, intruding on the executive branch and congressional power to regulate immigration.
Well, I agree with that, and you're rightly surmised that I'm not a big fan of the Massachusetts versus EPA rule, but not on the treatment of the states as being able to raise harms to their state citizens. I think that kind of sovereign standing is perfectly appropriate. Where I disagreed with Massachusetts versus EPA is how tenuous the claim was and how speculative it was. And if that's the dividing line, then Texas is on the much clearly on the better side of that line, because the harms that they are suffering are much less speculative, much more direct and immediate than anything that was being claimed in Massachusetts versus EPA. But the point you raise about being able to challenge any executive enforcement is a very important one after United States versus Arizona. Here's why I don't think it decides the case against standing here, because what the claim is not just that the executive is enforcing these laws in a more lax way than we would like, but they are doing so contrary to the explicit statutes of Congress. And so it's not that Texas is saying, we wish you were doing more here. It's that Texas is saying, Congress has said do more here, or not to do the kind of things you're doing. And the executive is ignoring it. And in the executive ignoring the policy judgments that Congress itself has made, and I think we both agree that the Constitution assigns plenary authority over immigration policy to Congress, then they are not challenging the federal government so much as making a separation of powers claim that has a direct harm causing to them that they are trying to then put forward to the court.
Let's go to our first question here, and hopefully we can continue this discussion as we go through the Q&A.
Yes, this is a very interesting discussion. I have one comment and one question. The comment is on Massachusetts versus EPA, which does treat states with special solicitude, and whether the dean is right or not, I think, is a really important issue here. And I personally have a problem with the facts. I think Dean Eastman said that this was analogized as to parents patriae. I think the case Massachusetts versus EPA is even weaker because, as Dean Johnson said, it focused on the ownership of basically shoreland by the state, so that they were seen as just a common property holder, and the Chief Justice, in his dissent, said this is really not a sovereign interest of the state. So I think this case actually is even stronger for standing than Massachusetts versus EPA because it does, as Dean Eastman said, raise a sovereignty issue about how the state issues its driver's licenses, expenses that flow from that. Now, is that doctrine defensible? Well, I think that if Massachusetts versus EPA is the law, then I think this is a much easier case. And I've reconciled myself to the view that the Lujan condemns private parties bringing actions because there's no filter when a private party brings an action. Any interest group or any private citizen who's injured can basically call into question the administration of federal law. Before a state can act, there's really a political process, an accountability process that the state has to go through. And arguably, the Lujan concerns about private citizens invoking judicial behavior are less acute than when states that have this constitutional status as quasi-sovereigns choose to invoke the judicial function. That suggests that there's more accountability and the jurisdiction of the courts are being invoked through a more legitimized political process. But that's the best I can do about Massachusetts versus EPA, whether it's persuasive or not. I don't know, but if it's the law, then I think this is an a fortiori case. The question I have is that I thought Dean Johnson raised an interesting issue about nationwide enforcement, and I guess I'd like both of the speakers to put some flesh on that skeleton. I'm not sure I see what the question is about nationwide enforcement if there is there are 26 or 27 states that are bringing this action, and if it violates the Constitution, why nationwide enforcement is problematic. So I'd like to hear more about that. It's an important question, but I don't think I have heard enough to evaluate the position.
Well, I can offer some thoughts. Many times actions will be filed against the Immigration and Customs Enforcement trying to stop a policy of the administration when it comes to immigration enforcement, like detention or something like that. Ordinarily, you can't get a nationwide injunction unless you get a nationwide class certified. And that's sort of a basic, injunctive relief rule, and it's the rule of, I think, all the circuits. Situation, you only have one state that's prevailed, at least in the Fifth Circuit's view, on showing that it had suffered an injury in fact. But nonetheless, a nationwide injunction has been issued. It just seems to me if you're going to have the rule that applies to people, individuals who challenge an action, you should have the same kind of rule that applies to the states. I don't know why the other states, which have different rules and allegedly different injuries, because not all states would be, necessarily be issuing driver's license or subsidized driver's license, like the state of Texas does. It just seems to me curious, and it's hard for me to justify. I could have one rule for classes that challenge the work of immigration enforcement, and then another rule for the states. You could make some kind of state sovereignty argument, but I'm not sure why that would make a difference.
Now, in the NFIB case involving expanded Medicaid, there were, again, 20-some states challenging the rule, and then another bunch of states, I don't know how many, that said, well, we want expanded Medicaid, and Florida doesn't speak for us. And there was a nationwide injunction there. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of the other referent point for me, is that there were states on both sides of the issue, but the court said that this was excessively coercive, insufficient notice, and therefore the states have the authority to do what they want. And so, it may be that the states face injury, if the behavior is beyond the constitutional power, I'm not really sure why that's a problem. We saw that with the same-sex marriage case.
That was the point I was just about to make. Both We had statewide injunctive issues and non-class action cases that should have had effect only on the parties to the case, in the California Prop 8 litigation, for example. But the challenges to the Federal Defense of Marriage Act resulted in nationwide injunctions issued by a number of lower courts. There was a great dispute about that. It's a very interesting question. I don't think it turns on whether each individual state themselves has an injury in fact. You need an injury in fact in order to get standing, but the ruling that the president's actions are unconstitutional would be a ruling that could have nationwide effect, even in states that didn't themselves have injuries where they could have brought that challenge themselves. The court's been lax in how it deals with the scope of injunctions by the lower courts. One of the reasons why I think it takes cases like this is once the Supreme Court issues its ruling, then the fact that not every circuit in the country has a similar ruling kind of mitigates against the nationwide aspect of the decision.
Right. I think that last point. Again, the caller, that last point I think is really important, is that the issue becomes, in practical terms, a non-issue once the Supreme Court rules. That may be an issue at the lower court level, but not at the Supreme Court, because once the Supreme Court issues its ruling, there may not be a technically binding determination. Even if the court were to rule, there's no nationwide injunction, but once it rules on the merits of the case, then there's no court in the country that would disagree when the issue is on all fours. And immigration individual cases may vary based on facts, but this goes to the power of the president to exercise authority in this case. I was also interested that Youngstown Steel didn't seem to enter into the analysis for Dean Johnson. I think that's a pretty important background case here. And you know, the discussion by Justice Black and the majority, and even all the opinions, but certainly by Justice Black, when he talks about how the executive order in Youngstown Steel is really not faithful execution of the law, but is in fact making of the law, and the executive order has all the ramifications of legislation, that. When I taught that just the other day, that really resonated pretty well with me about this U.S. against Texas case.
Yeah, I do think that would come into the take care analysis, and I do think that's important to remember the nature of the relief being conferred here. It's not making anybody a lawful permanent resident or doing anything other than giving them temporary respite from relief. So it's not making law in the sense, I think it's doing what's been done for a long period of time in terms of exercising prosecutorial discretion and deferred action. So I don't, and there's no permanent relief here. And that's actually, to me, it's a critical way of, an important way of approaching the case.
Yeah, I have to disagree with that on a couple of points. One, that may be technically true. A future president could theoretically revoke the deferred action status, revoke the work authorizations, seek to recover earned income tax credits that have been paid and Medicare and Medicaid benefits that have been paid. But the political reality of it is everybody knows that's going to be an extremely difficult thing to do politically, if not legally. Once having obtained the entitlement, there's no question that some courts would at least say that they have now achieved a status. And the second thing is, this is dramatically different. If I've a minor drug user, and the U.S. Attorney's Office decides not to bring a prosecution for me against my minor possession, that doesn't give me a license to continue to possess as if it's now lawful. And that's what makes this dramatically different in kind than the normal prosecutorial discretion. The president has not just said, we're not going to initiate the deportation proceedings against you. But as a result of that, we're going to deem you as lawfully present in the United States and make you eligible for a whole slew of benefits that flow from that new status that the statutes simply don't allow. And that's where I think the take care clause really is dramatic. And it amounts to an effective change in the law, even if it's only a temporary one. It's a change in the law that the president has no authority to make. As he himself, on a couple of dozen different occasions over the last 6 years before he did this, himself acknowledged. And that's what I think makes this different in kind and really is a dramatic overreach on the use of prosecutorial discretion.
I do think that there's nothing the president's doing to try to confer anything permanent on the deferred action recipients. And they could be subject to removal tomorrow, for example, if they committed any crime. And they could also be denied relief and when they apply and put in removal proceedings. So I do think it is, it's not like these deferred action recipients are going to become lawful permanent residents and be naturalizing and becoming citizens. At most, they're in a sort of permanent never-never land. I also feel that there's a bit of exaggeration in terms of the benefits received. I mean, there is a regulation that allows employment authorization that Ronald Reagan, his administration, promulgated many, many years ago that has been relied on to provide employment authorization to people who have received parole into the country, who received other kinds of deferred action, and it's being applied in this instance as well. But I guess you couldn't view that as a benefit, but it's not the kinds of benefits that some people think about when they think about immigrants, like in California, be the CalFresh program or the TANF program or something like that. So I do think it's important that we're not talking about the welfare state or anything like that when we're talking about benefits to the deferred action recipients.
Well, but Kevin, correct me if I'm wrong here, but once the work authorization is granted and the guidance memo, both from Secretary Napolitano and the more recent one in DAPA from Secretary Johnson, specifically directs that the work authorization eligibility will be given. Once that work authorization is given, then that person can, so for example, if they're below the income threshold, they get an earned income tax credit. They don't owe taxes. They get to file a tax return going back to 3 years and collect retroactively 3 years of earned income tax credits, which are effectively a welfare program managed through the tax system. The being an eligible earned income tax credit recipient makes you eligible for a number of other welfare programs as well. So yes, technically the guidance doesn't confer those benefits itself, but by giving the work authorization, it makes people eligible for all those benefits, and that we're already seeing happening. And when you're talking 5 million or more people, that's a rather dramatic use of federal funds for reasons that not only were not appropriated, but were specifically prohibited for such use. And that's where I think the executive versus the legislative authority here comes. And the president, I don't think, can simply confer those benefits on his own through his own actions without an act of Congress, as he previously conceded, but now seems to have gone back on that.
Let's go to our next question.
Yeah, I have a question about the take care clause part of the case. One of the issues that the Fifth Circuit did reach was to say that this was an APA violation because the actions of the president were so inconsistent with federal law that they were arbitrary and capricious. They didn't reach the take care clause issue. I guess I don't understand how it would ever be possible for the Supreme Court in this case to reach the take care clause issue. It seemed to me that any conceivable violation of the take care clause would also constitute an APA violation as being arbitrary and capricious, and so therefore there would never be any possible need to reach the take care clause issue.
Well, I guess that turns on whether the court accepts or rejects the other argument on the APA that the administration has made, which is just, this is just a guidance for enforcement priorities, and therefore it's not subject to APA rulemaking at all. And if it's not subject to rulemaking at all, we don't get to the arbitrary and capricious inquiry under APA. If the court rejects that and then says you've got to go through notice and comment, and at the end of the notice and comment, your end regulation has to be not arbitrary and capricious, then I agree with you. That would be roughly the same inquiry on whether it violated the Constitution's take care clause. But they could avoid that reaching that issue in that term if they accepted the Department of Justice's argument that this is a prosecutorial enforcement priority memo, nothing more, and therefore APA notice and comment wasn't even triggered. Whether then it violates the take care clause would be front and center.
I think you're exactly right. It seems I don't see the court getting to the take care clause argument. I think that it could decide it on standing. It decided on either the APA grounds, but I agree with you that you could decide it on arbitrary and capricious grounds, or you would never get to the take care part. And so I do note that the court raised that issue on its own, although the state of Texas wanted that issue before the court as well. But I see it hard as a sort of a matter of constitutional jurisprudence for the court to reach to take this. If the court wanted to reach to take it, of course it could, but I just don't see it happening.
Let's go to our next caller.
Yes, on the issue of standing, it was noted earlier that if the states wanted to, they didn't have to issue driver's licenses to DACA recipients. But isn't that somewhat disingenuous of an argument, considering that there are groups like the ACLU and others that are suing states like Nebraska to demand that they do give driver's licenses to DACA recipients? And I guess my ultimate question is Dean Johnson saying that he believes states should not have to give driver's licenses to DACA recipients?
I certainly wouldn't say that, but I'd say it's up to the states to decide what they're going to do, and it is a subject to some contention in the states. Not all states issue undocumented immigrants or deferred action recipients or others driver's licenses. In this instance, the state has decided that it will. But I don't know the threat of litigation from the ACLU. I don't know if it's enough to use that to confer an alleged injury in fact. That does seem, if we don't do this, I guess the argument of Texas would be, if we don't do this, we're going to get sued, so we're going to do it from the beginning. But I don't know if that's the kind of injury in fact that the Article 3 was designed to allow access to the federal courts.
The lower courts here actually did take that up the issue, because it's not just the ACLU that's brought suits. I think Arizona and Nebraska both. But my recollection is that those suits have been given support by the Department of Justice itself. I may be misremembering that. But they're inconsistent positions, that Texas is firstly free to avoid its driver's license costs by changing its policy was inconsistent with the Department of Justice's position, or at least the ACLU's position in those other cases. But even if those other cases didn't exist, the Supreme Court on standing cases before has said, even though you can avoid the harm by changing your conduct or your policy, you don't have to. The fact that you would have to make a change to avoid harm is also sufficient to confer standing. And so I think that alone is enough. Let's assume Texas can say, okay, we're no longer giving driver's licenses to anybody on deferred action, and therefore we'll avoid those costs. That's a pretty significant change in the state's policy that is itself sufficient to trigger standing, in my view.
We're almost out of time, so do you each want to give just a short closing comment?
Sure. I think this is a fascinating case, and I think it has the possibility of being a very significant law enforcement as well as immigration enforcement case. And it also touches on difficult issues of power between the distribution of power between the executive branch and Congress. So I think that this case is well worth watching, not necessarily only by immigration folks, but by all people interested in the workings of the federal government.
I agree with that wholeheartedly, and thank Dean Johnson for a vibrant conversation here. I'll just add, it's not just the executive versus Congress, but it involves the separation of powers and what the role of the judiciary is in enforcing that line. And because this is a federalism case in many ways, arising by a state suit against the United States, it adds that unique contribution to separation of powers that our American Constitution brought, and that is federalism. And so I'm the head of the Federal Society's Federalism and Separation of Powers groups, and boy, this case hits on all of the possible fronts that we normally address there. So watch it carefully. It should be a very interesting case.
On behalf of the Federalist Society, I want to thank Professors Eastman and Johnson for joining us today. And thank you also to our callers. We welcome your feedback by email at info@fedsoc.org. Keep an eye out for our emails announcing upcoming teleforum calls. And you can also consult the full schedule of our upcoming calls on the Federalist Society's website, fedsoc.org. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this practice group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.